Tam sam sajivam. Sadvurtam sadvadutam parijana sahita krishna chaitanya devam. Shri Radha Krishna padam sahagana lalita shri vishakam vitamscha. Vanchikalpa trubhyascha kripa sindhu bhyevata patitinam pavanevyo vaishnavevyo namo namah. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. September 18, 2015, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 6. Creation of the Universal Form, Text 5. Padena vishata swasmin. Matraya vishvasrigana. Chukshobam yonyamasajya. Yasmin lokas chara chara. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. As the Lord in his plenary portion entered into the elements of the universal creation, they transformed into the gigantic form in which all the planetary systems and all movable and immovable creations rest. Purport. The elements of cosmic creation are all matter and have no potency to increase in volume unless entered into by the Lord in his plenary portion. This means that matter does not increase or decrease unless it is spiritually touched. Matter is a product of spirit and increases only by the touch of spirit. The entire cosmic manifestation has not assumed its gigantic form by itself, as wrongly calculated by less intelligent persons. As long as spirit is within matter, matter can increase as needed, but without the spirit, matter stops increasing. For example, as long as there is spiritual consciousness within the material body of a living entity, the body increases to the required size. But a dead material body, which has no spiritual consciousness, stops increasing. In Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, importance is given to the spiritual consciousness, not the body. The entire cosmic body increased by the same process that we experience in our small bodies. One should not, however, foolishly think that the individual infinitesimal soul is the cause of the gigantic manifestation of the universal form. The universal form is called the Virat Rupa because the Supreme Lord is within it in his plenary portion. Parena Vishita Swasmin Matraya Vishvasrigana Chukshobam Yonyamasadya Yasmin Lokas Charachara. As the Lord in his plenary portion entered into the elements of the universal creation, they transformed into the gigantic form in which all the planetary systems and all movable and immovable creations rest. And here Srila Prabhupada is speaking about expansion. Matter only expands when spirit is within it. Some years ago in graduate school, we had some study about metaphors and the way that people speak being indicative of their values. One of the things that fascinated me in that is how the majority of the people on the planet characterize something as being good and something as being bad. Generally, good is associated with expansion and bigness. You know, these countries compete to have the biggest building. I was hearing Prabhupada joking about how, you know, he came to the United States and the Empire State Building was 102 stories, and now they want to build a building that's 104 stories, you know, and they add some spire at the top to make it a little bigger. But in general, we think like this. I mean, we may laugh at people spending billions on a building just to make it 2 stories higher, but it is our general mentality. For many years, I ran a Gurukula, and the first question people would ask was, how many students do you have? The more students you had, the better they considered the school to be. It was very rare that someone said, what's the quality of the students you're producing, rather than what's the number of students. We become impressed by something big, both in space and in time. If something doesn't last for a long time, we also don't give it much importance. If someone does a wonderful project and 5 years later it closes, we tend to, again, dismiss the whole thing. Oh, it was a failure. It was a failure. You know, everything in the material world has an ending. And simply because it ended faster doesn't mean it was a failure. Maybe it did great good while it was existing. But our tendency is like that. Each of us wants to produce something that's big in terms of time and space. A lot of the reason people have children. Ravindra Srupu wrote about this in an article in Back to Godhead called Immortal Longings, that a lot of the urge to have sex, to have children, is, you know, my DNA will continue. I see myself in my children and in my grandchildren and my great-great-grandchildren. Prabhupada says the Bengali saying, you know, you live to see your great-great-grandchildren being born, then your life is successful. Oh, my dynasty will continue. You know, so something will continue. Right? I've written a book, and people will continue to read it after I'm gone. You know, I will leave some sort of legacy. Something will expand from me. There'll be some sort of expansion of bigger or higher or more. And something that doesn't expand, we don't think of it as being very valuable. We tend to dismiss it. We tend to think there's something wrong with it. You know, there was a saying in the ecological movement some time ago, small is beautiful. But we don't really think that way. It's not quite the way that we're wired. We want some sort of bigness. Even if the thing itself is small, we want some bigness, an expansion of effect. So in meditating on why this is so, we have to look at the fact that the Lord is the biggest. And not only is he the biggest, he's the biggest in space, he's the biggest in time, and he's always expanding. So it's not exactly surprising that we associate good with space big, time big, and expanding. Getting bigger and bigger, getting better and better. One of the recent, fathers of hypnotism. Of course, hypnotism is an old, old art, but anyway, in modern times, he would give people the suggestion, every day, everything is getting better and better in every way. And again, this is our mood. If something's good, it's getting better. You know, a good marriage is one that the love increases over time. Any good relationship is one where the love increases. You know, if you love somebody and it just stays at that level, again, we don't think that it's very good. And we're constantly trying to improve our situation. And what frustrates us to no end is when things contract. You know, when things get smaller and fall apart and decrease in value and decrease in volume, it's something that really frustrates us. So what is the nature of this increase? How do we actually have this increase? And here Prabhupada's talking about spirit and matter. So I thought we'd look at the nature of matter and the nature of spirit and what are they really? And then what's the kind of increase that we want and how to get it? So the nature of matter is that it tends towards decrease and chaos. That's its nature. It's called the law of entropy. So if you leave something material for a while, it starts falling apart. Here at the home, we have bicycles, and there's one bicycle in the back. No one's ridden for a while. It's getting covered with vines. And whenever I walk past it, I think about that if nobody does anything with it, the plants will continue to cover it, and eventually it will become earth. The metal, the plastic, plastic takes a long time, but it will eventually go back to earth. down the street, there's a person who has a property that's all overgrown with vegetation, and there's all these rusted cars on it. And, you know, eventually it becomes jungle. If you don't mow your lawn, it becomes jungle. You know, everything kind of falls apart. It becomes covered with dirt. It rots. It molds. It rusts. There's this cycle, budva puliyate, of creation and destruction, and anything that you're not taking care of, it tends to chaos and destruction. It just starts falling apart. And this is true with material things, but it's even true with our material relationships. You know, a devotee sent me the other day a fascinating study about mathematically, scientifically, how you can study successful and unsuccessful marital relationships. And it's very clear that to have a relationship, even maintain, what to speak of expand, you have to put in some energy, you have to put in some work. If you just leave it, it falls apart. You know, it was quite interesting. The researcher was saying, you have to make space in your brain for the relationship. He called it cognitive space. You have to put some energy into it. So anything in this material world, you know, the running of a business, a relationship between two people, material things, a plan, you know, anything. I have a very good friend whose modus operandi is to have wonderful, sincerely, really wonderful plans. And this person will put a tremendous amount of energy for a few days into getting the plan started, and then kind of sits back and expects other people to run it or it to run itself, and naturally it falls apart. And if you talk to this person, you know, they'll tell you, I have this problem. And you say, well, have you tried this? Oh, yeah, I tried it. But I tried it means, you know, I did it for a few days with extreme energy, and then I just left it. And it falls apart very quickly. So everything has to be, in order to expand, in order to maintain, there has to be this other influence. The material energy itself doesn't tend towards that. And in fact, Prabhupada talks about how the Lord is holding the planets like a handful of dust in the palm of his hand, and as soon as he would let go of it, then all the dust would simply crumble. And we find, in fact, when the Lord is no longer wants the material creation here, then it becomes again the pradhan. Everything disassembles, you know, like some kind of Lego toy that gets disassembled and put back in the box in its little pieces. So that's the nature of matter. The nature of matter is it takes quite a lot of effort to maintain something, to maintain a garden, to maintain a room even, a home, a business, a country, a relationship. It doesn't do it by itself. By itself, it tends towards destruction, decrease, and chaos. The nature of spirit is just the opposite. The nature of spirit is it naturally flows towards increase. Just as matter flows toward decrease, we talk about water seeking its own level. You know, the natural flow of matter is towards chaos, decrease, falling apart. The natural flow of spirit is towards increase of quality, increase of quantity, increase of sweetness. And it does that naturally. It's its nature to do that. It doesn't need an outside force. Matter needs an outside force to stop its nature. Right? So spirit also flows naturally like that. I mean, our experience in material conditioned life of our spiritual life for the beginner until one reaches the stage of a shakti, which is just the right outside the door of perfection, is that spiritual life also requires a lot of endeavor or it falls apart. Right? What we call our sadhana, our practice in spiritual life, doesn't seem to us like it increases automatically without effort. That's not how the practitioner of spiritual life experiences it. Rather, the practitioner experiences their spiritual practice as something else that's material. as something that's required. Okay, I have to set aside a time to do this, or it won't get done. You know, if you want to take out the garbage, you have to have a time to take out the garbage, or it doesn't get done. I have to have a time for my spiritual life. I have to say, okay, I'm going to chant my rounds at this time. If you don't set aside a time, the day goes on, it doesn't happen. And you have to make some effort. All right, I'm going to focus my mind. I'm going to meditate on Krishna. I'm going to read the shastras. I'm going to, you know, as soon as we don't make some effort, everything starts to degrade. We start committing offenses. We become lax in our practice. And Srila Prabhupada indeed said that until we become fixed, which means at least 50% passion and ignorance has been removed from us, it is a hard struggle with determination. It does feel like we're having to push it and go uphill. So the concept that spirit is automatically expanding and naturally without effort, just by its own nature, may appeal to us intellectually if we're at that stage. But we may not be actually experiencing it except in little glimpses here and there. So there may be some little, something like on a very cloudy, rainy day. So sometimes the rain may stop and the sun shows up. Or in the middle of the winter, there may be a warm day where you can go out without any kind of heavy clothing. So for the beginner, there's usually some free samples at the beginning, and then there may be some sunny or warm days in the midst of the struggle, where one gets some glimpse, some idea, some taste that, spirit is of a different quality. So again, it's hard for us in conditioned life to really understand as far as experience. What we can understand is what Srila Prabhupada talks about here in this purport, that even our material things only expand when spirit is involved. That he gives the example of a body. You know, if the soul is there, the body grows. Some friends of mine had a one-day-old baby die, and the body doesn't grow. You know, they're going to bury or cremate or whatever the little baby body, and it's going to stop growing. In fact, it's going to degrade. So we can understand from our material consciousness that it's spirit that expands. It's spirit that causes matter to expand. It's spirit that builds a addition to a home or renovates a home. It's spirit that expands and sweetens the relationships. It's spirit that keeps the business going or the country going. So we can see the nature of spirit in that way. We may not be able to touch the pure spiritual nature, but that's really how it flows. It should give us our material experience that it's only spirit that expands matter should give us at least some faith, that perhaps only on the intellectual platform, that spirit is always expanding. So what is matter and what is spirit? When we say matter and spirit, what are we talking about? Because in one sense, both of them are Krishna's energy. Maya dakshena prakriti suyate sa characharam etunanena konteya jagadvi paribarche. We have this characharam in that Bhagavad Gita verse. And Krishna is saying, daivi esha gunamayi mama maya dirachaya maya tatamidam sarvam jagadavyaktamurtinam. So this is Krishna's energy. Abhumirapan lo vayukam mano abhudarevacha. This is bina prakriti. It's a separated energy, but still it's his energy. It's still Krishna, and Krishna and his energy are non-different, as Srila Prabhupada liked the word. He liked to say non-different rather than the same. But sarva-kalamidam brahma, everything is Krishna. Everything is Krishna's energy. And for Krishna, there is no such thing really as the material energy. Krishna doesn't experience the material energy as the material energy any more than the president feels imprisoned when visiting a prison. So what do we mean by matter and spirit? Well, the definition of material is very nicely explained by the Lord himself in the Bhagavatam, chapter 2, canto 2, chapter 9, where he says, whatever appears to be of value, if it is without relation to me, has no reality. Know it to be my illusory energy. that reflection which appears to be in darkness. So matter is basically a consciousness, as Srila Prabhupada writes in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto, in the Krishna book, rather, that Maya exists only within the mind. It's a particular consciousness. We can say matter is also a thing. It's made of atoms and protons and neutrons. But material energy is only experienced as a particular state of consciousness. Someone who doesn't have that consciousness, someone who has a spiritual consciousness, does not experience the material world or matter in the same way. They really don't experience there being a material world of decrease and falling apart. It's not their experience. So when we say material, we mean seeing something as separate from Krishna, seeing things as being about my ego. Like Prabhupada says in this purport, one shouldn't think the infinitesimal soul is the source of the expansion of the universe. And that indeed, that consciousness indeed, is material. I am the doer. I am the source. Everything is about me. I am at the center. You know, even my spiritual life, it's about me and what I do. So that's material consciousness. We don't see the hand of God, the will of God in our life, as we've discussed before. That's what secularism is. Secularism means not understanding the hand and the will of God in our life. Not understanding that everything we're able to do, everything we see and hear and touch and taste and smell, is really the energy of the Lord, and the Lord is there. And that is material. I see things as separate from the Lord. You know, I see my home, my abilities, and my family, my job is separate from the Lord. You know, if I'm in the mode of passion rather than ignorance, then I have some religion. Religion appears in the mode of passion. Of course, the demons also have kind of religion. But anyway, religion is in the mode of passion. And, you know, I have that a certain time of my life, Sundays at 11 o'clock or something, where I have my religion. But the rest of my life I see as disconnected. So that's matter. Or I see things as connected with God, but I see God as my order supplier. I see God as my servant instead of my being his servant. So that's all material. And spiritual is love. Spiritual is giving. Spiritual is connection. How everything's connected with Krishna. Everything is about a relationship with Krishna and a giving to Krishna. And even from the position of a conditioned soul without much spiritual realization, we can understand how one is contracting and one is expanding. You know, if we even think about our very ordinary relationships with other conditioned souls in this material world, anything in this world, as soon as people become selfish and self-centered, everything contracts. And as soon as people become giving and other-centered, everything expands. Even on a material level, even within the modes of nature, we can see that principle acting. Now, I've done a lot of studies in the field of leadership and management, and it's fascinating. There's a classic book in management theory called Good to Great, where there was a study done of companies that went from good to great, and they were looking just at financial profits. But companies that went from good to great and sustained. So again, we're talking about expansion of profits and a sustaining of that expansion of profits. And they found that there was difference in the leadership. And among the differences they found in the leadership, one of them was that companies that either didn't go to great or didn't sustain that greatness was where the leadership was very controlling. It was all about them. They were some bigger than life, charismatic leader that made all the decisions and was shining. And as soon as that person retired or died, then the company fell apart. And the companies that went from good to great and stayed that way were where the leader was very humble, where the leader gave credit. The way they put it is that when things went good, they looked out the window. When things were bad, they looked in the mirror. You know, when things went good, they gave the credit to their employees and their associates. They didn't take personal credit. When things went bad, they took personal responsibility. When things went good, they took personal credit. And they were always thinking about how to please the employees. And those were the companies that expanded. The companies where the leader was very egotistical, the companies didn't expand or couldn't maintain their expansion. And where the leader was humble and giving, then they expanded. Another fascinating book that I read on leadership and management called The Dream Manager was about a company that was a janitorial custodian company where they would clean houses and office buildings. And, you know, it's not a very nice job working at night in office buildings cleaning toilets. I mean, it's not a very respected job by society. It doesn't pay a lot of money. It's not a very pleasant job. So there was a very high turnover rate. A lot of employees were always leaving, and high turnover rates cost companies a lot of money because you always have to retrain. A lot of it, time and effort and money has to go into retraining the employees. There was also a lot of waste of the cleaning products and so forth and so on. And one of the managers, one of the vice presidents, got the idea that the company should facilitate the employees with achieving their dreams. And again, this is very material, helping them buy a new house or taking a vacation to Bermuda or something like that. And as the leaders in the company started helping the employees to fulfill their dreams, people stopped leaving the company. The turnover rate went almost down to zero. People were trying to get into that company. You know, they had lines of people wanting to be employed there. The employees voluntarily worked harder, voluntarily took on new jobs, voluntarily started saving product and not wasting it anymore, and the company was just expanding, and then they were asked to help other companies. And so my point is that the principle that being egocentric, thinking about myself, my profits, my enjoyment at the cost of others, tends to contract and destroy. And having a giving mentality, a humble, giving, loving, caring mentality, tends to expand. And the principle of this is evident even within the modes of material nature. Even completely conditioned life, even without anything connected to God or religion whatsoever, just thinking about the modes of ignorance, passion, and goodness. And we see this principle is a fact. So what to speak of in the ultimate sense? In the ultimate sense, if things can expand so much when someone is loving and giving, even in a contaminated state, just imagine if one is truly and purely and really loving and giving, how much things expand. In fact, we have a lot of the dealings between Krishna and his pure devotees are for the purpose of expansion. Krishna explains this principle to the gopis when he leaves and returns in the Rasalila. He said that I act this way to expand love, that all this separation and meeting is to expand love. You know, I mean, when you read some of these pastimes of Krishna, it's like, what's Krishna doing? You know, he goes to one gopi and immediately talks about how he loves that gopi's rival. And, you know, well, why is he doing this? Because this game of separation and meeting and teasing and playing, and he runs ahead of the cowherd boys and they can't see him, and they have to, or Krishna with his parents doing something naughty. And all of these pastimes are ways of increasing love. They're ways of increasing affection. And these pastimes are quite the difference between Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. You know, one reason that people don't get involved in spiritual things so much today is they have this impersonal concept of spirit, where it is very static rather than being dynamic. But with Bhagavan, and especially with Bhagavan Sri Krishna, I mean, even, of course, with Narayan and Ramchandra and Nrsingadev, there's always expansion of love and expansion of varieties, but especially in his form as Krishna, Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam, especially with Krishna, there's the full variety, Akila Rasamrita Murti, and the full expansion of that variety. So if we want things to be bigger and better, if we want an expansion of excitement, everything that we love, you know, an expansion of peace, if we want these things to keep increasing, everything that we hold dear and that we want, that we desire, if we want them to increase, then we need to get closer and closer and closer to the spiritual. And as we get closer and closer to the spiritual, as the material, the me-centeredness decreases in our lives, then we more and more experience the nature of spiritual as simply an automatic flow. An automatic flow towards better and better. And if we're not experiencing that, then we need to decrease the material in our lives. I find it fascinating and frightening that one can go on for decades chanting 16 rounds, three Gayatris, worshipping the deity, studying Prabhupada's books, but the main content of one's thoughts and anxieties and desires can still be material, can still be me-centered, if we don't make a conscious effort to change that mentality. If we're doing our sadhana more or less as if it was some sort of religious ritual, the eighth offense on chanting. If we say that we believe that spirit is something different from a religious ritual, but if our actual practice of it is like that, that we're thinking, you know, I'm going to do these rituals and then I'm going to go to heaven, you know, if that's our mood, then we don't so much experience that expansiveness of spirit. So it's changing the mentality. Instead of me-centered or expanded me, you know, instead of it's for me or it's for my family or it's for my business or it's for my society, even my spiritual society, instead of that, it's for Krishna. It's for Krishna. It's for Krishna's pure devotees. It's out of love. It's individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. Individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. So, questions, comments?
You did your studies. So, I have a
question. Prabhu, you're going to have to talk up if possible.
Okay. Mataji, you have talked about your experience with leadership studies, and you quoted the exams of leadership studies, and linked it to spirituality and further consequences. Sometimes the focus is not me. Sometimes the focus is work. If you know the managerial grid, the focus is on the work, not just for me, but for the society or for the company itself. And then also people become impersonal. So how do you deal with that? The focus on my own selfish ego, the focus on the other person, and the focus on the work itself.
Well, even if you're focusing on the work, you know, or you're focusing on the company, it's always ultimately about a person. It can't really ultimately be impersonal. It's not really possible. I mean, even if I'm focusing on the work itself, who's getting the satisfaction from it? Am I trying to get satisfaction from it? Am I hoping my boss will be satisfied? I mean, I'm looking for some entity who's going to be satisfied, isn't it? Is it possible to do work for the work itself without thinking that anyone's going to be satisfied by the work itself?
I agree with that. So why I was coming to that, when you said when something good happens, they give credit to the employee, and when something bad happens, they give credit or they find fault with themselves. But many times what happens is that when the leader is trying to focus just on the work, even for the company's sake or for the greater sake, he tends to behave very rashly with the employees, and I suppose he forgets the how, as you quoted the example of the janitor company, that they should be, every employee should be helped in achieving a dream of the individual.
Right. Well, this wasn't really, I wasn't really giving a class here on how to be a good leader. That wasn't really my focus here. Okay, how to be a good leader. I mean, we could have a class on that, but that wasn't the class. The point here was I was using some examples from the world that if we want things to expand, then we can't be focused just on ourselves and what we're going to get. We have to focus on pleasing others. And that this principle, that expansion happens when we focus on pleasing others and not being so egocentric, and contraction happens when we're egocentric, is applicable even if we separate everything from religion and spirituality. So I didn't get into those things in detail. You know, the companies that go from good to great, not only does the leader give credit to the employees, and the leader is concerned also about the company instead of themselves, and they also take care of the employees. That's a whole group of factors going together. But the basic principle is there, that companies that make more money over time and sustain that are ones in which the leaders care about the people. The same is said about a country, a nation. You know, and if you look at governments that don't take care of the people, that are just full of corruption and bribery and taking care of their own self, the country falls apart. It just does. You know, the population may expand. I mean, that's another factor. But the country falls apart. And nowadays, even the population starts contracting. I mean, we have countries in Europe where the population is contracting so much that they're terrified that the whole country is going to dissolve into nothing because no one's having babies anymore. So if things just contract. When people are cared for, when the leaders are not just thinking of their own paycheck and their own adoration and they're really trying to serve the citizens, then things expand. So this principle operates, as I said, even on a gross material level, even completely within the modes. So we could get some idea from our experience of how things work even without God consciousness. How much more so that would be true with God consciousness. Because it's not absolutely true without God consciousness, it's relatively true. When you have without God consciousness, it's a relative truth that when people are selfless and giving and caring, that things expand much more than if they're selfish and egoistic and taking. You know, it's a relative truth, because on the material platform, even if I'm giving and selfless, I'm not really giving and selfless. It would Prabhupada call it expanded selfishness. So it's not actually spiritual, but it's a little closer. Things are not black and white. Does that clarify things?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay.
Mother Imala, but how do we get rid of our selfishness, even when we're trying to get spiritually advanced in Krishna consciousness? That's ultimately selfish.
Well, it's very nice. Krishna Das Kaviraj approaches this problem, I can't remember whether it's in chapter 3 or 4 of Adi Lila, where he talks about the gopis. And he says, it seems that the gopis are after their own happiness. They talk like that. They say, you know, we want to see you, Krishna. We're unhappy if we don't see you. It appears like that. But their happiness, the reason they want their happiness, is to make Krishna happy. Let's think of this in, again, with some ordinary material examples that we're aware of. So when the husband comes home from work, let's go to a real traditional old-fashioned example, and the feminists can kill me later. When the husband comes home from work, if the wife is happy, you know, like the Bhagavatam talks about that the woman should be beautifully dressed, the house should be clean and scented with incense and perfumes, The children are happy, you know, the meal is cooked, comes home and everybody's happy, then the husband feels happy. If he comes home, I mean, I remember when my oldest child was newborn and he had what's called colic, where he would just cry for about 45 minutes every day, inconsolably, from 6 to 6:45 at night. And I remember my husband coming back from the temple one day, and he comes home to this screaming newborn, and I'm just holding the baby in my lap with tears streaming down my face because I had, you know, nothing I did would console this baby. And, you know, my husband opens the door, looks at us, and closes the door again and walks away. I mean, the greatest gift that we give to people is our happiness, and our happiness in relation to them. Now, if we're just happy, they like that. If the people that we love and care about are happy, that brings us happiness. Just that in and of itself. You know, if your children love their spouse and love their children and everybody's happy, just that gives you some satisfaction, even if you only talk to them 3 times a year and you only see them once a year. Just that they're happy, right? Isn't that what we say? We say, oh, as long as they're happy, then that's enough for me. Now, if they're happy because of us, that's their greatest gift. What greater gift could they give us? If someone says, I want to see you because I just like your presence, I like being with you, that, even if we have everything in the world, if we're such a rich person, we own everything, if there's nothing wanting for our sense pleasure, if all of our desires could be fulfilled, still, we would become happy. Our happiness would increase if somebody became happy because of us. If our very existence was the cause of joy to someone. This is one of the reasons why people keep dogs. You know, you come home from work. I mean, I was reading about why dogs do this. It has to do with their relationship to wolves and how the wolf pack treats a member of the pack who's left and then returns. So it's really, it's not what it appears to be. But anyway, you know, the person comes home from somewhere, shopping or work, and the dog is just jumping up and down and licking their face. I mean, again, there's a biological reason why they lick the person's face. But anyway, greeting them and so excited, you know, and that this dog is happy to see me. I've told the story many times that we had ducks to eat the slugs in our garden, and although my husband didn't do any care or feeding of the ducks, when they would hear his vehicle coming down the road, they would just rattle over as fast as they could to the gate, and they would quack like crazy to greet him, and he just loved it. He just loved it. Or where I'm staying here, we have a 2-year-old. And, you know, when anybody returns to the house, but especially his mother or father, he gets so excited. You know, oh, mama, dada, you know, and he'll run up to you and he'll give you a hug and he's just smiling and beaming. And what greater gift can you give somebody? That kind of situation is what we live for. It's what we work for. It's the taste that drives us to do everything. So that's what we can give Krishna. What can we give Krishna? Patram pushpam palam trayam yom me bhakti prayachachi tadaham bhakti pari tamashnami prayatmanai. I mean, you really think Krishna needs a little water? And I talk about how some devotee's house I visit, they have these tiny little cups on their altar. You know, most devotees keep a cup of water on their altar for the deities. And usually the cups are pretty small. I mean, even the cup I have on my altar here, it probably can hold about, I don't know, 5-6 milliliters of water. You know, what's that? I have been to homes where the cups are so small that literally they hold 1 drop of water from an eyedropper. You know, that Krishna needs that. Krishna needs our little flowers with Kaliyuga scent. I mean, we go in temples, they buy these roses with no fragrance. Krishna, I mean, what are we offering to Krishna? You know, really? What do we have to offer? are spaced out, inattentive, trying to focus hour and a half from chanting his names, hoping we can finish quickly so we can get to our other business. I mean, what are we offering Krishna? Really? The thing we're offering Krishna is that he makes us happy. That he makes us happy. Instead of trying to be happy by his energy separately from him, that we're happy by him. Now, intermediate stage is we become happy by serving him. It's the service that makes us happy. That's the platform of Ruchi. And we should feel some Ruchi even in the lower stages. But at a Shakti, one becomes happy. Krishna makes us happy. Seeing the deity makes us happy. Hearing Krishna's pastimes makes us happy. And Krishna's thrilled. He's absolutely thrilled. So wanting to be happy by Krishna, that is love. That is love. Now the gopis say that Krishna, if my misery makes you happy, then my misery becomes your happiness. There's a funny story with Lord Chaitanya where Jagadananda went to Vrindavan. He visited Vrindavan and stayed with Sanatana Goswami. And he brought back different gifts for the devotees. And one of the gifts he brought back was pilu fruits. It must have been dried, considering the long journey by foot. So pilu fruits didn't grow in Orissa. The local people weren't accustomed to them. Like here in Hawaii, I go to the farmer's market every week and I make a point to buy fruits with which I'm unfamiliar. So the devotees were not familiar with these pilu fruits. What are they, right? And I'll look at the market. What is this? They say, how do you eat it? What do you do with it, right? How do you prepare this? And at the market, there's all these tourists there. It's mostly tourists at the market. And they're always asking, you know, you hear all around you, what is this? What is it called? How do I eat it? How do I prepare it? So the devotees didn't, and Orissa didn't know. And nobody said anything. So none of the devotees who knew said anything. So the pilu fruit has a seed that you're not supposed to eat. So the fruit is very tasty, but the seed has this kind of spicy, bitter taste. So the devotees who knew, they ate the fruit and spit out the seed. And the devotees who didn't know, they actually bit into the seed and their mouths made this funny expression. You know, what we look like, this facial expression we get when we eat something that's too spicy and sour. And everybody was laughing, and Lord Chaitanya was laughing. So the devotees felt, if I can make Lord Chaitanya laugh by eating this seed, that is my happiness. Again, we experience this sort of phenomena even in our mundane relationships. You know, if I'm in some kind of awkward position, but it's giving you happiness, I can feel then happiness at my awkward position. Isn't it? Don't we have that experience? So love is when I want to bring happiness to the beloved. And my sacrifice, my difficulty, my austerity to bring happiness to the beloved becomes my happiness. You know, if we think that spiritual life means that I'm unhappy, who would want to take up spiritual life? So, yeah, in the beginning, we still have our materialistic consciousness. So we think, okay, well, if making Krishna happy is what makes me happy, then I'll make Krishna happy so I can be happy. And that's okay in the beginning because we have to be where we are. We can't be where we're not. Just like the scriptures even offer material benefits. If you read this story before sunrise, you know, on the full moon day, you'll get good children and a nice spouse and you'll cure your diseases. And we get these benedictions in the Bhagavatam, to speak of other scriptures. So that may be necessary at first. I mean, doing book distribution, you don't usually sell any books by saying, here, take this book about selfless love of God. Who's going to buy it? You know, that doesn't work. It doesn't even work. You know, when you're preaching to devotees, it doesn't work. I haven't found, generally, when preaching to devotees, if you start off a lecture saying, okay, who wants selfless love of God? Everybody would be bored. they do something else. So that's, we have to start with where we are. So yeah, I'm concerned with my own happiness. Gradually what happens is that pleasing Krishna becomes so satisfying that we forget about our own happiness, not because we don't have it, but because it's already just a given. It's just there. And the other day when I was out shopping with my daughter, there were signs in the supermarket, 1 in 5 children in America is hungry. And I looked at my daughter, I said, how is that possible? There's such an abundance of food in America. I mean, we were in this shop that was just mammoth, over flooding with food. And then there's, you know, welfare programs, food stamps. How is it possible for anyone to be hungry in America? You know, it's just like, whoa. But I don't think about it. I don't think about, is there going to be food? Am I going to be fed? It's not part of my mood. I wonder if I'm going to eat today. It's just there. It's just part of my life. I was reading a study once that people who are wealthy or from wealthy families, especially wealthy families, people who grew up with wealth, that they're much more likely to assume that everything's going to work out in life, because it usually does for them. And the people who grew up in poverty are much more likely to think that things aren't going to work out. You know, when you have everything, you tend to just not be focused on the things that you just have. You just have them. You take them for granted. They're not in your consciousness. So in the same way, when the devotee is concerned with Krishna's happiness, they're so fulfilled that their own happiness recedes into the background. Any interest in their own... Well, of course they're fully happy. Their happiness is ever expanding and ever increasing. And you know, yadyatma supersedati. So they stop having any consciousness about it. It stops being a motivator. You know, again, going back, I don't know why I'm going there today, but going back to leadership studies, you know, my doctoral dissertation, my doctoral thesis was on job satisfaction. And the theory is that there's a lot of factors that only act as motivators when there's a lack. So if you're poor, then money is a motivator for your work. But once you have enough money to meet your basic needs, money stops being a motivator. In fact, money can be a demotivator. I know people who say that as soon as I'm getting paid for this, I don't want to do it anymore. So that's only the case, you know, once you have enough money for your basic needs. But once you have enough money for your basic needs, the money recedes in your consciousness. You're not thinking about it anymore. The same with the work environment. So it's something like that with Krishna. We're so satisfied with serving Krishna that our own satisfaction becomes irrelevant to us. We become focused just simply on pleasing Krishna. And Krishna is focused simply on pleasing the devotees, right, by the way. Krishna's not... I mean, we could say Krishna's the ultimate taker, all right. But he's also the ultimate giver. And Krishna's happiness is on pleasing the devotees. What makes Krishna happy is seeing the devotees happy because of him. And what makes the devotees happy is seeing Krishna happy because of us. When I'm the catalyst for Krishna's happiness, that makes me happy. When Krishna is the catalyst for my happiness, that's what makes him happy. And there's a competition between who can make the other person happiest. You know, material world is, there's a competition for who can get the most happiness. And the spiritual life is, there's a competition for who can give the most happiness. But to have my own happiness be my motivator in the beginning is inevitable, and just don't worry about it. Literally, don't worry about it. It can't be helped. It's what it is. And focus on, I'm going to become happy by making Krishna happy. And pretty soon, one will become so happy by making Krishna happy. And one's happiness is so much just a part of one's life, and it's a given, and it's there, and it's assured, and there's no break, and there's no threat to it at any time whatsoever, that any concern and consideration for it disappears. That's how it disappears. It doesn't disappear by suppression and repression and denial. The quest for our own happiness disappears because it is just simply always there, without cessation and with always expansion. And that happens gradually as we focus on Krishna's happiness, whatever our motive may be at first for that focus. Is that okay?
That's a wonderful answer. Thank you so much.
Sure. We could take one more.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, sure.
Again, I'll echo Ramananda's sentiment. You're giving great classes and very nice points. I've taken some notes here, but the purport in your talk reminded me of a powerful philosophical point Sri Shinamarsh once made against evolution theory, because, as pointed out in your class in the purport, matter cannot do anything without spirit. So he would call evolution theory fossilism. And he said what they're proposing, spirit or consciousness, is coming from stone. And he would reduce matter to its most contracted form, something, and the point was something so much more expansive, like, and complex and valuable, like consciousness, they're saying is coming from something less valuable, some inert substance like stone. So then he would counter that with, it's much more reasonable to theorize that stone is coming from spirit or consciousness, that stone is one idea in the world of consciousness.
That's perfectly said. And it's just the concept, yeah, from stone, from a chemical soup, from a dot of stone. If we look at the evolutionist claim, it is so absurd and it is so unbelievable. You know, the main criticism of spiritual understanding of creation and maintenance is that it's supernatural, it's unbelievable, it's outside the range of our experience. You know, we don't experience some big Mahavishnu and a four-headed Brahman, blah, blah, blah. But their explanations are a lot more unbelievable and more supernatural and more outside the range of our experience. You know, I haven't seen any of the stones on the property here create a house and give birth to babies. And it's crazy. It's really madness to think that matter creates spirit, that matter expands on its own. Anyway, thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.